Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-hosts...
Boz Benno.
Peng Chi.
Setting up a segue.
Sorry.
Okay, everybody, welcome to episode 156 with myself, Oz Benno, and Dan Q.
Greetings and salutations.
The Mian Team.
I'm recruiting peons. Are there any takers?
Magin.
I don't know today. I lost it. I had too much caffeine.
And with hopefully less caffeine, Peng Kui.
I was going to make a peon from Warcraft 2 joke, but it's been too long and it wouldn't be funny anymore.
Rationalism Finisher is reusable. Back in June, with the latest patch for Gods and Kings, and it was also for Vanilla Civ 5, but anyway, Chief Slapahoe, this person has one post, and I will facepalm in Mackie's absence. He says, once you max out the Rationalism tree, you can keep switching between it and the Piety tree, and you will receive the two free tech bonus every time you go back to Rationalism. This may be intentional or not, but it seems game-breaking with high enough culture per turn. A couple of days ago, someone else with just one post still, Suspect TV, says confirmed, and it was elaborated on in a related thread in August, on August the 8th, by Being For Itself. It was really, really very specific. You get into the Renaissance. If you have policy saving on, and yes, we're talking about Civilization V, of course. If you have policy saving on, then you may want to consider saving some of it if possible. Fill out the Rationalism tree. Just fill it up and use the two technologies on whatever is expensive. Get enough for one more policy. You have pretty much just won the game. Open up the Piety tree. Piety and Rationalism are opposed, so they will put you into Anarchy for one turn. During Anarchy, your population will continue to grow, and you will still get points toward Golden Ages as well as Culture. End the turn. The following turn, you will have the Piety tree open and the Rationalism tree closed. You can reopen the Rationalism tree right away. This will once again put you back into Anarchy. When you reopen the Rationalism tree, it will break the policy bonus you have for filling out the entire Rationalism tree. You will immediately get two bonus technologies. These are in addition to the two technologies you got the first time when you filled out the tree, and the turn after you picked them. The following turn, you will restart the entire process. Once again, you will be able to switch to Piety and deal with Anarchy, and once again, you'll be able to switch back to Rationalism and collect your two technologies. Moyang said, how in the world was this not noticed? Great, another reason we cannot play multiplayer until this is fixed. Paltamak is like, please tell me this is a joke. How is this not game-breaking? Two techs per two turns is like 500 times better than the old great scientist research agreement slingshots. Come on. Islandia argued that this is not game-breaking in single-player because you just don't use the exploit.
Yeah, it's not game-breaking if you don't use it.
Of course you don't.
Except for all those Hoff people. Oh, wait. Oops.
I want to know if anybody's like booted up an old version and seen if they could do this when finishing out Piety gave you free policies. Because then you could get a free policy and just flip back and forth over and over and over again like without even having
that's
to wait.
One fast culture victory.
Actually, yes, it would be. And I don't think anybody ever said anything about it, but I would think, because I know some people were working with Piety and Rationalism as strategies for a culture victory, and you would think one of them might have accidentally found that, but it was never brought up. No, actually, well, this is the exact same bug as Autocracy Liberty back in the day, before the switches over, where you would get all the Liberty stuff back, because it was all free stuff. Every time you had filled out Liberty and then switched over and back. And that got fixed. So you would think, and maybe it's just, you know, assumptions that shouldn't be made, but you would think if there's an exploit because of free stuff and social policies due to conflicts, then they fixed it once, they would choose not to let it get broken again. This is far more dangerous. Two free techs, yes. You can just blast your way through the whole tech tree very quickly. And it's worth far more than a great scientist or a research agreement.
I have a friend who liked to say, when you make assumptions, you make an ass out of you and mumptions. So there's that.
Yeah.
I don't hate making an ass out of mumptions. So.
No, I wouldn't want to do that.
When Chief, and no, I'm not going to say the whole username again, said that this may be intentional or not, I really don't see how this was intentional.
It can't be intentional.
Islandia further said that for multiplayer, it's probably not game-breaking because most multiplayer games are decided before the rationalism tree can be completed.
True.
But even so, just because it's not, maybe I'll phrase it as not as game-breaking in multiplayer for that reason, it still does need to be addressed.
And it's not like it's multiplayer and people aren't looking at demographic screen every few turns. Like, hey, that guy just went up 10% in the last 10 turns. Wait.
In the chat, the great Mr. Popo says, finding it and reporting it are two different things. What I found interesting about this is that the first thread on this that's in the confirmed bugs sub-forum for Civilization V on Civ Fanatics, it has less than 900 views, and the second thread was posted in Strategy and Tips, which I found really ironic. It is stuck on page 3 right now and has less than 1,400 views. It wouldn't surprise me if there was a really dedicated, interested enough modder out there, they may be able to go into the XML and fix that. I don't know exactly how that's coded, but that's kind of beside the point. And I can also see some people saying, Dan and company, why are you raising this on the show? You're just making more people aware of it so they can go and exploit it. Well, it's one of those things where see if you can replicate it for yourself, first of all, and if you really think it's an exploit and you shouldn't have done that, if it's single player, then save your game before you do it and then reload the save. Yeah, people know that this is an issue, so 2K and Firaxis are like, hello.
I found that funny. That advice was great. Because go do this and then find out you shouldn't have done that in the first place.
But Dan, Dave Cummings cheating.
That the Civ 5 Hall of Fame is absolutely fine on this because we don't allow policy saving. Which I think was one of the things that Phil, you might have had an issue with it in the beginning. But yes, so we've not seen this.
Yeah, but that was a very minor gripe of mine when it comes to Hoff stuff. It's a topic for another time, I believe. All right.
Actually, I've been wondering this myself, so it's actually kind of good that this is the topic that has been given to me. Are there any benefits to open borders? And I've actually heard that brought up a few times, not just in this one thread we're kind of looking at on the 2K forums. It's somebody whose name is I Like Food, which I think that is a fantastic name and approve wholeheartedly. Says, I remember that in Civ 4, if you didn't open borders with another Civ, they'd get ticked off. I usually refuse it in Civ 5 with no apparent negative effects. Is there some positive effect of which I'm unaware? And honestly, I've been denying open borders to just about everybody in my recent games, too, unless I think they're going to be adversarial with someone that I hate who's on the other side of me and then let their troops get through and die. But other than that, I can't think of a real benefit.
I'd have to look at the Diplo list again, which I think I have somewhere around here. There's a defined list for what actually counts as benefits. I'm pretty sure it wasn't in the list.
Pretty sure, too. I wonder, though, the only thing that I think might be in the list that might relate is maybe the we share no contested borders might last longer if you're closer with open borders or something. But
well, there's also the trading one that would be more directly, like traded recently. So it would take more than just a single open borders, but if you're trading a few things, it would kick in.
My experience with the traded recently is that it only kicks in if you give them a particularly generous deal. Like, I've traded, like, dozens of luxuries fairly with somebody and not gotten the benefit, as opposed to giving them one luxury for free, and they'll immediately have the we've traded recently bonus.
I don't see a direct open borders bonus or negative, so there's no, you know, you refused my open border request, so I'm going to go kill you now. That's a slightly different thing. And I think that's something you already said. You know, if they want to go kill somebody on the other side of you and you don't let them get in and they can't get around, well, they do have a military right there on your border. And if they think that you're just as good, they will go through. I've actually seen that a few times where they'll just like declare war on you just to get past.
They actually had it in Civ 4, and it's worth noting, before you didn't take a panel for not open borders.
Yeah, I feel like there should at least be a penalty. Like, I had a recent game where I was at friends with Carthaginians, and we teamed up to kill the Koreans. And they ended up with one city like on the opposite side of my territory. And I feel like there should at least be a penalty if you don't open borders in that kind of situation, because they can't possibly get a trade route to their city if you don't open your borders, which seems like it would piss them off.
They might, but not in a normally diplomatic way. It could be one of those, you know, things that happen, like they want their trade route. Well, their trade route needs to go through you. Okay, let's go through you. Whereas if you opened your borders, they would get the initial thing that they were looking for and therefore not have to care.
But is EA at the stage where they're actively looking at particular trade routes, that you are denying them a trade route by denying open borders? To me, the AI is not really that smart to pick that up.
No, I think you're looking at it the opposite way. They can detect trade routes individually because each city is supposed to be connected to the capital. And if a city is not connected to the capital, which is easy to detect, it's also quick to find out, okay, no harbor. You know, if you can't get a harbor, then obviously you need a road. And the AI can draw lines on the map for the roads. And if the only way is through your culture border, that's also easy to detect. It's not that hard to get to that point.
Yeah, makes sense.
I would agree with you that it's not going, hey, that bastard's blocking my trade route because...
An internal trade route rather than an external trade route sort of thing, like within their own cities rather than a trade route to an external city.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I like food here. Was talking about positive benefits and negative benefits. I think, and we've addressed this very much, that he's talking about those diplomatic modifiers, those that you can see or those that you should be able to see and not able to see. And we talked about some indirect penalties and or benefits for opening your borders or not opening your borders. I went into the XML to see if I could find where this was discussed, and you can find it. There's a couple different XML files, one if you just have vanilla, and then there's another for the expansion. And a number of these do talk about borders, but there's nothing specifically about open borders. I mean, there's like, you know, I made a promise to move your troops from their borders. You refuse to move your troops away from their borders, or about buying land, those kind of things, but nothing about you refused open borders as a negative or as a positive. We have had open borders. From the threat itself, Furball said the only positive to giving open borders is if you sell open borders. And that's the thing. You don't just have to give open borders for open borders. You can buy open borders. But you don't have to give up open borders yourself. And as far as giving, for instance, like a faraway civ open borders, the only thing now, of course, in Gods and Kings is that before you can open borders, and I'm trying to remember, they moved open borders. Is that at civil service now?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, whereas before it was at writing, but at writing you now get an embassy, and you first have to be able to establish an embassy to then be able to open borders. Anyway, so... Yes, the positive is, you know, selling open borders. It's not as lucrative as it used to be because, of course, 50 gold earlier on in the game is going to give you a greater impact more likely than later in the game.
There's a question about improving diplomatic victory, and I guess I lied. It's not actually a question. It is a poll. What do you suggest to improve diplomatic victory? There are multiple choice offers. 16 people have voted so far. If this was up on CFC, there'd probably be about 1,000 votes by now, since many people hate this particular topic, that is, diplomatic victory. So basically, he wants to improve diplomatic victory. Oh, actually, last day I started a thread on Civ Fanatics about how Diplo Victory could be revamped. And this is Magian, kind of like the Explorer, not quite. He figures that the biggest flaws of the diplomatic victory is the massive gifts before the vote, obviously, the coup frenzy, oh, and the worldwide declaration of war on the last turn before the vote. Of course, the massive gift before the vote is the just spam all your gold onto city states just before the turn before the vote, because the AIs go in the turn timer. Sort of way, you go first, followed by the AIs. So you will never actually have the last word when it comes to the diplomatic victory. So on your turn, just because you did something doesn't mean the AI is not going to change that before the vote. And that's where the worldwide declaration of war on everybody happens, because city states can't gain money or get bought off by civs that are at war with them. And of course, the coup frenzy, which happens... as soon as the diplomatic victory is turned on, there's a frenzy of coups. So when the UN is done, or the UN gets built, all the AIs stop and go, hey, the UN vote, let's go get some city states. So, yes, there's a bit of coup frenzy. But those are his problems. And obviously the first two are just purely exploitive. And you're just exploiting a system. So this has come back to the old sell everything you own to each AI in turn to get all their money and then DAO them and then do it again and again. And then just buy up all the city states while you're at it. That's just a pure on exploit. And if you want to play that way, you can. But then don't complain about that. I mean, if you want a real diplomatic victory where you did diplomacy, then that's okay. But don't complain about mass gifting and DAOing people if you're doing it yourself. Don't whine.
Corner of the world's energy market. I mean, gold market.
Yeah. So anyways, he had some suggestions, and then other people suggested some other stuff, and that all got put into this multiple choice pool. So the top one so far with the most votes, city-states should vote for the civ with whom they've been allied for the longest time. Now, didn't quite fully read exact details on that, but I have heard this before. It's come up in many places. Generally, what that means is that the game should be tracking who they're allied with. Every turn that you're allied with a city-state, it just ups a counter. And then when it actually comes to the vote, they, even though they might be at war with that civ, even though they might be allied to somebody else at the time, even if you've nuked their arses back to one population, they still vote for you. So it's a little flawed in the concept, but it's better than just mass vote buying at the last second, potentially. At least what most people seem to think. I love this one. Randomize the countdown before the vote. Hey, guys. Something about, hey, you gave me a 10-turn counter. You told me it was a 10-turn counter. Why is this going off 40 turns later? Because that would happen. So that did get some votes.
My favorite one actually has, like, really, really low votes. The make it so that gifts aren't effective on the turn when they're where they're made. Like, if giving a city-state a gift made it slowly count up the points that you get for it, so you couldn't just, like, drop 4,000 gold on it on one turn and have it instantly love you, as opposed to slowly gaining, you know, gaining points until it gets to the point where it would be your ally. I think that would be best.
It just pushes the timing back, though, really.
If you're not planning on a diplomatic victory and somebody builds the UN, you could end up being doomed then. Whereas, like, in the current system, somebody builds the UN, you're like, oh, crap, I guess I'm going to dump a bajillion dollars on all these city-states now.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of the problem with the, was the UN victory, with the diplomatic victory or the gold victory, depending on how you want to call it. It's a one-shot deal. As in, you get one shot. Either you won or you lost. There is the third option where everybody screws up and no one won on the first shot, but there's no progression. So it kind of does drive you to, you know, doing something extreme just to make sure that you don't lose by accident. Because even if you're the one who built the UN and you're the one who's had allies all the way through the game, you could be the one losing if you aren't the last person to do the turn. So it's a turn order issue in amongst that. So, I mean, just improving the diplomatic victory could entirely be about changing it from a one-shot deal to something bigger. But that would probably take an expansion.
I almost feel like there should be some way to for some counterplay there. Like right now, it's basically who has the most gold, they win. You know, whereas they could make it so, you know, maybe if your military is powerful enough, you know how you can threaten city-states and demand money. Maybe you can threaten them into not voting or threaten them into, you know, any other kind of like diplomatic situation. Because, I mean, look at the Soviet bloc and the real world. You know, it's not like all of those countries really loved Russia, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's many ways to go for it. And none of those are seeming to be on this list. Some of them are like city-states shouldn't vote for civs who DAO'd somebody X turns before the vote. But that's just in general. And all AIs like to DAO. So.
Yeah, and when I first read that, I thought, okay, city-state gets attacked by Civ X. You declare on Civ X, oh, we're not going to vote for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute.
A lot of these like suggestions in the poll seem like Band-Aids rather than real solutions. Like, you know, I think that the real solution would be some kind of change to the city-state system where you cultivate a relationship over time instead of the current system where you fulfill condition X or give them X gold and it gives you X points, and that's the end of the transaction. The Romans have been with us through thick and thin, so we're their best friends, and they don't need to just give us gold every X turns to keep that friendship. We're going to stay their friends because they've done so much for us kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, and, I mean, that's the one benefit, actually, for that concept, because, you know, if you're the ally and you're spending gold on them, you get their stuff. But if you've been their friend or ally for long periods of time, then you get their vote. I mean, that's the bright side of that style.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at something like Civ 4, and it wasn't just for the diplomatic victories. It wasn't just one thing. You couldn't just bribe a Civ. You had to have open borders. You had to have tech trading. You had to have resource trading. You had to be, you know, shared civics, all these different things. You couldn't just give them money to vote for you. You had to appease them in more than one level. And maybe that's part of the thing. It's not just one thing you have to do. It's more than one thing. It's a bit of an opportunity cost sort of thing. Like, you just save up money and buy all the city states. Maybe you have to do more than that. You know, something else.
I think that Civ 4 kind of model, I mean, that doesn't work in the paradigm that they've chosen to use in Civ 5. You know, if you were playing a big multiplayer game in Civ 4, everyone's voting for themselves. Why wouldn't they? You know, it's just the rational thing to do. You should vote for yourself. And, you know, in Civ 5, we've got this idea that, well, the AI is actually trying to win the game now, guys. So why would they vote for you? And of course, in the expansion, they just made it impossible to vote for yourself, which, you know, is the only reason you'd ever vote for anybody else. But now you should just vote for the person who you think has the least chance of winning, you know? Yeah. So
well, that was a major improvement along the line. Instead of just like everybody vote for themselves and city states, allies are the ones. At least this way with, you know, forcing the AIs to vote for somebody else, they'll at least vote for the person or the player or AI that they like the most. So that at least that way you can potentially win. But the problem is still that city-states are the core, and city-states are these tiny little places that you can spend money on and win just by having that. You don't have to play the diplomacy game with the major AIs. You can be at war with all the major AIs as long as you're nice to the city-states.
Also in the poll was the option for make it so that alliance of a city-state can't change before a certain amount of turns. And of all of the ones that are listed here in the poll, the ones that are specific, and yes, there's more that we have to delve into, that's the one I like the most. There is the gold issue, so I know there needs to be more than that. But when you have this situation where, okay, if they can't change that alliance before a certain amount of number of turns, it's like having a peace treaty with a quote-unquote AI proper where, all right, yeah, maybe after the peace treaty is over, I'm going to go out and I'm going to declare on you. But there's no like concept in the diplomacy like we had in Civ 4 of a ceasefire. It's a peace treaty like in Civ 4, as we see in Civ 5, and it's a set number of turns. So if you become the ally, probably shouldn't be with friends, but become an ally with the city-state for a certain number of turns, the thing is then it just doesn't become a matter of how much influence do you have over the city-state, which of course now in Gods and Kings is not just gold-related. There's the expanded quest system, and there's, you know, generating the most culture, the most faith, getting a particular great person, and the like. I like that enough that I think that should be explored a little more, but the other ones I don't really think they're much of a starter.
Yeah. Well, except for the coup thing. The one I don't think we talked about yet is coup should decrease influence in all city states because their governments get suspicious, which seems a little weird to me, but possibly. But and then set up a countdown between two coups in the same city state or a preparation time free for a coup. I can see why people are really upset about the two coups in the same city state, because if everybody's got a spy in the same city state, you can have like a good 8 to 20 coups per turn, and the AI will try.
I feel like all they really need to do to change coups is just make it so that the amount of time that the spy is in the city affects the chance. So like, you know, you can't just pop drop your spy into, you know, Brussels and just hit the coup button and the chances are the same no matter what. If they just made it so that you need time to set up the coup, then you couldn't just coup and instant coup back and coup back and forth over and over again. You'd have to wait until your percentage chance gets good enough again. And then it would be like, you'd have to plan in advance, which is, you know, a foreign concept to Civ games, right?
Now there is some prep time. Technically the spy still has to get there and get set up.
Yeah, what, two turns?
Yeah, something like that. But, you know, some delay between attempted coups probably wouldn't be a bad thing. Even just adjusting the coup formula itself, I don't like how it was totally implemented in the long run. It's too easy to coo. And the AI will coo at 1%. Like, that's not a rational choice. And I know it cooed at 1% because I can calculate how much influence it gained versus how much I lost. And so they will make those Hail Mary shots, but they'll do it for no reason. Like, halfway through a game. All right, let's coo for, you know, 3 or 4% chance. Why? Because our spy's going to die 90% of the time.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that I went from 160 influence one time to 14. Like, and I wouldn't have tried that, you know?
Yeah, no rational person would try it below, you know, a good 60, 70%. Like, I could see why you would try it at 60 in a, you know, I need to try this to get that guy for a specific reason, but no, it needs to be a little higher chance before most people would set off a coup, because that makes sense.
And of course, there's also the diplomatic victory is fine as it is that presently has one vote.
Ooh, one vote. Yeah, I guess it depends.
A vote of confidence.
Yeah, a vote of confidence for it. There are many ways to change, to improve it, to expand it. There's lots of ways to expand on it. And I guess it's a question of, is it the gold victory? Because we do have a productive type victory. We have a military type victory. We have a tech victory. We have a culture victory. So is this just purely the gold victory?
Otherwise known as the economic victory, diplomacy.
Yeah. Because it's not really a diplomatic victory. It's more of an economic victory. Because the person with the biggest economic power will be the one buying up most of the city states. So it's more economic. Diplomatic victory to me is more about the major civs. I mean, sure, okay, getting enough of the minor civs on your side is great, but diplomatic victory to me is you're going to get enough of the major civs to decide not to want to kill you anymore, and basically you've managed to forge an alliance or forge a way to basically stop need for war because you've all, you know, made peace with each other. That would be a more of a diplomatic victory, and that would be a lot harder to do, which is probably why they don't do it.
Random Ancient Ruins, posted by Slynn. First, before anything else, I want to acknowledge that I know that you disable ruins. Now, what do I not like about ruins? I don't think the victor of a strategy game that takes several hours to play should be determined by a random number generator. Not like we haven't talked about this before. But anyway, some variance in power level between ruins is fine, but the difference between a good ruin and a bad one is huge. I don't want all the ruins to be the same. That would be boring. I just want to lessen the gap between the useless ruins and the extremely powerful ones. So how do we fix them? Number one, reduce the amount of faith the first religion ruin grants. Make it give no more faith than what is required to form a pantheon, minus one which you get from meeting a religious city-state. This way, rushing a shrine would be the correct play to get the pantheon you want. Two, remove the barbarian and map ruins, or somehow merge them with each other and the lackluster gold ruin. Maybe you get to see all the barbarian encampments and a map of some area and the gold amount you get from the ruins. Still not as good as any other ruin, but not useless. Make the science ruin not pick the tech you're currently researching. Plus, take one of the techs that takes the least amount of time to finish. This will eliminate the risk of a nearly useless science ruin and also eliminate the randomness from getting a tech much faster than what should be possible. Or you could simply make the ruin give a bonus to science. And culture ruins should scale a bit. The culture ruin is only good very early. You get too much culture a turn very fast, and I think it should somehow scale with how much culture you're currently making. And with the science and the culture one, I like that, it being a boost based on what you are currently generating. Now, when we're talking about, you know, most of the time that you're seeing ruins in the game, it's early on. So as a percentage base, it's the first few turns and you're doing, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 6 science. If you say, ooh, I just got a 10-15% boost, well, you're not going to notice any difference to that. So maybe make it an absolute value. But still, rather than getting a tech right away, and certainly not the tech that you're currently researching. I realize that perhaps you just switched to that technology this turn, but the game seems to know when you're only a turn or two away. And yes, I know a turn or two is still a turn or two, but
you assume the game is built to troll you on purpose.
Well, you might as well operate on that assumption, and you'd be as disappointed when you play the game.
The game cheats, we all know.
Yeah.
Well, it would be appropriate to just add an option to, like, you know, we have no ruins as an option, but why not a option where it's like all the ruins are gold, or, you know, something that just completely flattens it, you know, makes it, you know, bland. Still rewards exploration, but not randomly, like very static way.
So it's just varying the amount of gold that you get from the ruin. That's the random nature. If you said it's all gold based.
Oh, yeah, but I'm getting only 5 gold this time.
I wouldn't randomize gold. It that much. Only 5 gold. Oh, great. I'm glad I built that scout.
Yeah.
You lose money, Joel. Oh, oh, oh.
Well, even with the gold thing, rather than getting a whole bunch of gold up front, maybe you get X amount of gold per turn for X number of turns. So that way it's not such an immediate boost. Oh, look at this. I can buy an archer now.
Ooh, how about the rune turns into
present value calculations, Dan. Present value.
Yeah. How about the rune turns into a spot that adds 3 gold per turn to it? Yeah. It turns into a tile you can work.
Like a
ancient civilization.
Crap, exploiting what were the monoliths in Alpha Centauri?
You get a unit of mind worms.
Yeah.
Oh, like, God. Mind worms? What's a mind worm? Oh, crap.
just grows fungus.
The science thing, I don't know. It's limited to just the first 2 lines attack, so you can't really get super tech out of it. And the first line attack is only, what, 30 beakers at most?
I never liked these things in Civ, but at this point in time, not in vanilla release, but right now, it's by far the least game-breaking results from the ruins. Because even in Civ 4, you could get, like, horseback riding on turn 12 or something. And,
or even a horde of barbarians and completely ruin your game.
Yeah. Orbs aren't as game-breaking in Civ 5 either. Like, this kind of stuff, it still annoys me. I really don't think it's actually good for the game. I don't understand personally why people find it fun, but this, you know, it's gotten to the point where it's more of a nuisance as far as I'm concerned. And since a lot of people like it, whatever.
Well, as long as it's small and just randomizes some stuff, like, otherwise every single game would look exactly the same for the first few turns. So at least it pushes a few different buttons. True. As long as it doesn't push buttons too hard, and that's what can happen. Like getting, say, calendar on turn 10, because you finished pottery and you found a rune, that speeds you up by a lot of turns, and that is actually kind of hard. So I don't mind, like, making the science rune just give you a flat, say, 30 beakers. It's the same as a first level tech, but yes. wouldn't actually give you, you know, something. Mm-hmm. And it would go on to the thing you're currently researching, so it would also slightly make sense. Or it can just be to a random tech, so, you know, even that way, then you can finally, you technically would attack, but not too bad.
Speaking of, I like how the map ruins, because, you know, how, like, 90% of the time you find one and it's a map of the ocean. Thank you very much, you know.
Gotta love that.
What I want to know is how your scout even realized that that was a map. I found a blue piece of paper. I think it's a map. Of over there.
Well, no, it was the barbs. The barbs gave it to you. They were friendly.
But it's a map of the ocean. It's literally a piece of paper that has been painted blue.
Yeah. That's it. Over there, there's water.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be the sky or the sea. You know, pick one.
Or maybe it's just a blue piece of paper, and your scout just thought it was a map of the ocean.
Yeah. Oh, really, gentlemen? Everyone knows that when you find a map, it was left there by the aliens. I mean,
haven't you seen Prometheus?
Yeah, they scouted and went, wow, there's too much water here. Never mind.
Yeah, it's like the aliens from Signs showed up and they were like, wait, why would we invade poison acid world? Let's not do that. Let's just leave a map of it.
Yeah, it's like, oh, there's water there. I don't mind the maps. I actually really like the maps as part of it. When you don't get a purely water-based map, okay. But even the water-based map, you know, not to go that way. Because there's usually you don't get that one while you're standing on the coast. Usually you get that one when you're a few tiles in. So you know, okay, good. I don't waste my time going that direction. And sometimes you're going to hit culture. You'll see culture borders pop up and other stuff like that. So you can actually make money off that map by quite a bit of money if you knew that somebody is over there.
That's another good point, actually, is you find this ancient map, right? And it reveals to you the mysteries of the great beyond. How did the ancient map know that the Aztec culture borders were over there or would be over there in 4,000 years?
Well, that's just part of the game.
It's just part of shut up.
Yeah. Take that. Barb encampments, okay, that's the one most people don't like, but as long as you haven't already scouted all the barb encampments, knowing where they are is a great place to not send your scout.
Yeah, if you reveal the barbs, then it'd be like, oh, okay, well, now I know where they are, and I don't feel like I have to take honor in order to reveal the barb camps. I realize that happens every turn when afterwards in the honor camp, but still, I actually do like that one, especially in the early game. Like Majin said, avoid going there right now.
Besides, barb camps tend to spawn near people, like either city-states or other players. So if you do know that there's a bunch of barb camps over there, it's a good chance somebody else is over there, too. And you just know which tiles not to go near. So
it's a beacon.
It's a mini beacon of death for the ships, anyways. Hey, guys, we got a campfire coming over here. Come on, come here, come here. I want to show you something. Did you bring the map of the water? Because we're going to need some. I think the only thing I could say is broken is the faith one. Just because...
Yes.
You don't get... like insane amount of faith if you don't have a pantheon. You just get a small amount, but that small amount could be equal to a pantheon. And that kind of sucks, and that's more than what the culture rune would normally give after the second one.
The other problem is if you pop the pantheon and you are near any kind of terrain that you can pick a pantheon that gives you faith, you don't actually have to plan to go into a religion at all. You can just, oh, herp a derp, I got a religion, even though I didn't do anything for it. Whereas, at least with all of the other ruins, there's nothing that's just like, oh, well, my entire strategy has been completely changed because I popped this ruin.
Yeah. Well, actually, after you found the pantheon, you can get up like a ton of faith out of it. There is a before and after pantheon faith amount.
Yeah, it's 60 after and
10. Yeah. And let's see, how much is 60? That is 60 turns worth of faith if you only have one city. Pretty sure you're not going to get the same amount out of a culture rune or anything else.
I almost feel like the correct number of faith to come out of those camps, if you're going to have faith camps, would be, like, I'd say 6 pre-Pantheon. That way, if you happen to run into a faith city-state and get one of those, you can get a Pantheon. And then maybe like 20 max for the post pantheon one.
Yeah, it should be reasonably low, but high enough to be of value without breaking anything.
You know, Drusky had a number of suggestions, and I'm not going to go through all of them that he had later in the thread. But I mean, one of them was exploring the ruin gives a production bonus in a nearby city. And I'm mentioning that one specifically because I thought, oh yeah, we have science bonuses with the technology. We have faith and we have culture. We don't have a production one. So I like that one to explore. But then he also has one in here, rescue a random great person. And I thought, oh.
No, that's just insane. New strategy. Great engineer turn one.
I could actually see that being like a ruin trait that could be like toggled on after like 1500 AD or something like game time, where it's like, hey, you found Amelia Earhart or whatever out there.
Yeah. Actually, the one thing I don't understand is why they keep complaining about the gold rune. And maybe I have to wonder, like, do they know how to play this game? Sometimes. They're like, the gold rune sucks. It should be upwards of 200 gold. Like, what?
No, yeah, I don't get that either.
It should be a free building. Yes. Is what it
but only when I get the ruin. No one else gets 200 gold, just me.
Yeah. Like, 200 gold is most of a worker and almost half a settler.
Or an archer and a half.
Yeah, it's just an archer. Straight up, well, depending on game speed.
Yes.
But that's like insta units. And there's already a thing where you can, you know, sell off 5 gold per turn for 112 gold to the AI. If you got a gold rune at 200 gold, you could do that 5 gold per turn thing on like before turn 10. Hey, look at me. I got a free worker right off the mark. And now I improve all my stuff and let me go.
Hey, look at me. I'm an AI on immortal difficulty.
Yeah. Like, I got your bonus. Yeah, there's a reason that gold is not that high from runes, because it shouldn't be that high. I think 100 is the max, or at least close to 100. It's a big boost as well. Like, if you hit a gold rune for 100 gold early in the game, that's a lot of turns worth to save up now that you just skipped. Yeah, I don't mind some rebalancing of some of the runes, as long as it's not a rebalancing so it's so flat that it's bland. That none of them matter.
So Phil probably has a few things to say on this topic. He probably doesn't even have to read the thread. Just the title enough is enough.
Well, the title is what puts the troll face on my face. Okay, this thread is started by John129Pats, and the thread title says, "Should honor be rewarded in next game's multiplayer?" And, you know, the first thing that came to mind is the honor social policy. And I'm like, well, it is rewarded. I mean, it might not be the best thing ever, but you get great generals to boost your military. You get a great general. You can take discipline. You get more experience. You know, what do you mean it's not rewarded? And it might not be as good as Liberty in a lot of cases or tradition, but it's there, you know?
That was my first thought, too.
He means it in the traditional sense of honor. Like, when he first started playing, he had a lot of his workers stolen by his opponents, who would then delete the workers immediately so he couldn't get them back and things like that, which takes me on a bit of a side story. My first true player versus player multiplayer Civ 4 game ever, I played against my roommate at the time, and I killed him on like turn 7 with my starting warrior. That was he thought it was better than me, too. That was very fun. Anyway, and also he's had this John129Pats. Has had situations where, like, he made a gold for die trade and then got declared on two turns later. I could have sworn that only worked on the AI, but apparently you can get something. So there's that as well. See, I think I even made this comment in a post for once that, like, no one would fall for this. But, you know... Or no, someone was telling me that nobody would fall for this, that no human would accept such a deal.
See, yeah.
I knew better. That's right. The point of the thread is he basically wants there to be some reward for behaving honorably in multiplayer, or I guess more penalty for not behaving honorably. I don't know. Like, it's going to be difficult to put that into a game and multiplayer without completely changing how the game plays. I think, to be honest, would just be you get some sort of huge and, well, not huge, but some reasonably strong for continued honest relations with somebody. So, like, say you've been trading gold for resources for like 100 turns. Well, now you both get more than either would have gotten if you just kept on to your resources in total. So there's some incentive for cooperation in that regard. And you still have incentive to backstab and kill each other as well, as part of the normal course of the game. But something that actually tells you, okay, I want to behave honestly with at least a few civs and have good relations with them, because that gets us both ahead, and it leaves other people out of the loop. You know, basic free-for-all types of strategy here. And that's one way you could implicate that. There's no way. Like, I don't care if my civ auto-declares on somebody across the world because he backstabbed his friend. I'm not going over there unless it's helping me. You know, you are a person. It's up to you to decide whether or not dealing with somebody is good or bad. I don't think you need to hold people's hands too much here. I would like to see a little bit of incentive just to have, like, dynamic diplomatic relations where you get bonuses for working with each other. But that's about where you can really draw the line in multiplayer. Other than that, it's up to the players.
Yeah, I think this is crap.
but it's equally a thing is that when you play multiplayer, that you have to in some way be trustworthy. Like, if you you play it often, you know the people that you can trust. You know the people that you can't. You know equally that everybody's going to try and win the game and backstab you at some stage. But there are people that basically you can't trust because they will never agree, you know, that they will never, you know, pull through an agreement or whatever. So you don't trust them. It's like, in a way, there is inherent reward for being a trustworthy person, given the fact that you are still trying to win the game, and at some stage you will take the steps that you have to take to win the game.
Yeah, but I think the real solution here is to just have a regular group of guys you play with. The same way, you know, when you play a tabletop game with your pals, I know that if I make a deal with my friend Steve, he's going to honor it, you know? And so I'm a lot more likely to make deals with my friend Steve than I am to make deals with my friend Ryan, who's going to backstab me at some point. He's probably going to cheat me. And yeah. I think that's the real solution here. You know, don't play with random people you've never heard of.
And we don't need Fraxis or anybody trying to force people to play in certain styles or follow a morality path.
Yes.
Screw your morality. I replace it with my own. And the next thing I have to say is, what about the next game? What about this game?
Asking for Civ 6, like, immediately, just like they were asking for Civ 5 immediately in pretty much every other iteration.
Well, I mean, it's because every single one of them is the worst game ever when it comes out, and so we need to replace it immediately with the new worst game ever, and then make the old ones look good.
It's kind of true, though. Their release dates have been really bad for a couple games in a row now.
Yeah.
Like Civ 5 Vanilla, Civ 4 Vanilla, they were both really rough when they came out.
And Civ 3 was rough as it finished.
Yes, I was going to say Civ 3 is rough to this very day.
I don't understand why people are considering it's basically an exploiting a game mechanic for some of the complaints that this guy had. What game mechanic? The one where you're giving him all your stuff? I mean, you don't have to limit yourself to 100 gold. You can give him 3,000 gold for that die.
Yeah, and this is like calling that a game mechanic is like claiming that, you know, making a peace treaty in real life is a game mechanic.
There's a mechanic there, but there's no flaw in it. He decided to give that 100 gold over. He basically said that he believed that his ally, who probably had military near him if he declared on him 2 turns later, was trustworthy, and that wasn't the case. You know, that's a mistake. You can legitimately interpret that as a mistake, because it is.
If there were no gold per turn option in the game, I would be right with him, but there is a gold per turn option.
Yeah.
You can protect yourself against this.
Yes, by saying
yes,
no.
Absolutely.
Like every time I ask Dan for his money.
Can I have some of your money?
Hey, Dan, can I get some money?
$5, please.
Yeah, really, to echo what people have been saying here, that he's asking for in the game to be making a value judgment on what you do or do not do. And it's true that he's not suggesting that you're not going to be able to do something, but rather that if you make a certain choice, then you're going to be penalized for behaving in this particular way. And really, the honor part, that value judgment, that comes down to the people that are playing. Because in one group of people, what is considered an honorable action or an acceptable action, which of course is, honor, so good and bad, right or wrong, moral, not immoral, legal or illegal, it comes down to the people in the group. Taking somebody's worker in one group might be regarded as that wasn't a very honorable thing to do, whereas in another group it might be like, oh, damn, that was smart. How come I didn't do that? Or, okay, you stole my worker. Good idea. I'm going to go and steal
your city.
There you go. Right? So, yeah, it's just, I think honor can be rewarded in any multiplayer game of Civ right now, or even any multiplayer game period, depending upon who you're playing with. And yes, it plays a little bit into the game mechanics, but it comes down to some in-house rules, first of all. And if an in-house rule is you don't steal workers, then the quote-unquote game penalty is the host says, in a discussion, either, hey, that's one warning, two warnings, three warnings, you're out, three warnings, you're out right away. Everyone else declares war on that person, even if they don't actually do anything practical to do something on it. So, yeah, it's trying to add a value judgment that's not a game mechanic, but it's not like it's in a personal mechanic. It's a value judgment, and it's a choice.
You're supposed to be able to play the game with backstabbing.
Furthermore, a lot of this stuff, is when you're playing with other humans, you're not limited by the diplomacy mechanics in the game. You could say, hey, Bob over here he wants to make a deal with me, but I think he's going to backstab me. How about, you and I on the side over here, without Bob's knowledge, make a deal that if he backstabs me, I'll give you X gold and we'll go to war with him, And you can't do that with the AIs, but you can do that with a human,
Yeah.
Yep, toggle the chat panel.
And humans aren't limited to the actual game for revenge, If you're playing there and there's two of you two brothers sitting there playing online with some other people, one backstabs the other, I could see one of them turning around and just smacking them.
I was going to say, you hit him in the head.
Or pulling the plug. Or pull the plug on the computer. See you win the game now.
Here, let me send you 3,000 packets per second across this LAN here.
Plus, we have long memories, mostly, sometimes, for stuff like that. So if somebody backstab you, even if you're in the 100th game since the last time you played with them, you're going to remember, hey, that guy backstabbed me.
Yeah, you may not remember exactly how they backstabbed you necessarily, but you remember that emotion because it's a strong emotion, so you're going to respond accordingly.
Yeah, and in the new game, you might not be so nice to them, and you might backstab them. And that's not something a game value judgment can handle, or should. Actually, it shouldn't handle. It probably could, but it's just...
I was about to say, it shouldn't, or at least not very well. At the very least, not very well.
Yes, we should not be trying to force people's values on others in a game that's meant to be played by whatever way you want to.
Yes, we limit our forcing values on other people to real life.
Yes.
It's not worth it in a game.
Yeah, if you declare on me, I'm so going to key your car.
Yep. Oh, but the one thing in this thread that seemed to be actually useful that I saw, Silver Futurist near the end of the thread, said peace treaties are lasting only 10 turns. It's a good point. Let the players to choose how long the peace treaty actually lasts as part of their negotiation. That makes more sense. So you don't have great. A stuck, like, we're at peace for 10 turns or whatever. Maybe you just want to make peace and you go, okay, 5-turn cool off. And then, you know, whatever happens, happens. Or you go, you know, you want to make peace with me? You're going to have to take a peace treaty for 100 turns. Therefore, you can't attack me again. I don't think anybody will sign that, but...
You could if you really wanted to set up, like, some collusion where you could then have absolute trust in somebody to not declare on you and vice versa. You could, like, set up a deal where you declare on each other and then make, like, a 250-turn peace treaty.
Yeah, and?
Like a literal enforced permanent non-aggression pact or, you know, whatever. That would be really amusing, actually.
Thread on Civ Fanatics by Biscuit about how espionage could be expanded in Civ 5. It says, I really like the new espionage system. Stealing tech and the intrigue system is awesome. I would say it's the most useful espionage system that has ever been brought into a Civ game. Be cool. I really like it, but I feel it could be expanded upon in a number of ways. One, causing unhappiness. Two, stealing a lump sum of gold per term from other nations. Three, destroying nearby improvements. For destroying buildings. Most of these could easily be used in Civ 5 and it would open up more options for your spies.
No.
Yes.
I'm glad espionage is back, but at the same time, that doesn't mean that I want to see some things brought back that were in Civ 4.
My feeling is that no part of a game should feel like a spreadsheet. Like, I always turned espionage off when I played Civ 4 because it felt like a spreadsheet. You don't really see it. It doesn't, like, kaboom, unless you smuggled a nuke into a city, which was very visceral and cool. But other than that.
That's what he wanted. Plant nuclear bomb.
Oh, yes. That was suggested by My Bologna. My Bologna.
So let me see if I can rearrange Biscuit's initial post to sound more the way I would say it. I really hate the new espionage system. Stealing text is stupid. The intrigue system is okay. I would say it's the most useless espionage system that has ever been brought into a Civ game. I really hate it, and I feel it could easily be thrown out of the game, and no one would notice.
The espionage system so far, if I had to pick one that was best, was Civ 2, where you have a unit that goes to a place and does a thing. You see the unit. Other players can interact with the unit, like there's counterplay. All the good things about the Civ 5 system were contained in that.
I know, I'm being mean about the espionage system, but that's because I think it's mostly badly implemented and designed. The intrigue system is a good idea. It was good. The city-state election rigging, I like. Coups obviously need some work. Tech stealing, I don't mind the concept of tech stealing. I just don't like how it's done. It should be a more of a per turn you get some small amount. Towards it, not let me start stealing tech while the biggest thing you know about is steel, and then by the time I'm done stealing tech, I get GDRs.
I don't mind the tech system or the espionage system that much in 5 because it's very fire and forget. I don't feel like, I mean, the part of it that you do feels like a spreadsheet, but you're not in it that long. But the one thing I don't like is that the intrigue system doesn't work on humans. I feel like any system that they put into the game should work equally well, you know, when applied to a human or an AI.
I like the menu system that they did. I don't like the individual unit spy thing. I don't think that fits, especially because of the one unit per turn and things would just get really messy with that. So I do like the fact that it's not unit based.
Me too.
Planting misinformation. I like that as a concept. Somebody's spying on you and you just go, hey, did you know?
It's not just about, okay, am I going to be successful? And if I'm successful, I get, you know, a big boost. But there's also the potential payoff is equatable to the possible fallout if you're not successful, or maybe even if you are successful.
The problem I have with that, though, is what's the counterplay? I feel like any mechanic you add to the game, like to help to make one player have an advantage over another, which is fundamentally what this is, needs to have a way for the other player to counter it.
If somebody has their own counterintelligence operative going on, then they would potentially find out that somebody tried to plant that information, and then you could share that with the other two so that you could get a diplomatic bonus for sharing the fact that a third party was trying to plant misinformation. Or that third person could turn around and go, hey, you know what? That actually is a good idea. I'm going to go do that.
You know, we talked earlier with regards to the, you know, with the ruins not being able to instantly give you a technology or right away finish the technology you're currently doing, at least directly, but rather give you a boost to your existing science production. Well, in stealing technology, rather than being able to steal a particular tech, when I say steal technology, perhaps take some of their technology output just for that one turn and transfer it to you. Where if you are really behind, of course, then I know there's some balancing issues in there. And you could say, well, wait a minute, you'd have to kind of limit that, because if you're able to take, I don't know, 10% of their science output, but that means for you that translates into more or less one or two technologies in a very short period of time, whereas for them you don't have something similar, then okay, it's going to cost you more, either in terms of greater amount of time that before you can actually take a particular technology, and then, of course, that even if you are successful in taking that, there's also the risk that either it could be even in multiplayer, that the human would be alerted to, or the AI would be alerted to, hey, guess who just took some of your technology? And then you could say, well, how would the game then decide whether or not you even found out that so-and-so was able to steal some of your technology? You should always know that, you know what, our science output this turn has been limited because someone, you know, extracted some of our science output for their purposes. So I think you could have a stealing, but it's not so much about the technology as it would be about the output.
As long as there's always a way for you to say, well, I have a way of preventing this from happening, or I have a way of, you know, turning this back on the other player. I mean, that's what espionage is all about in real life.
And rage quit is not an acceptable
yeah.
What?
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-212-88-7659. That's 441-212-88-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Really, when a guest starts to sing, it's free game. Haha, free game!
Mackie wasn't here.
It's more desirable to sing when Mackie is here.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, the only reason to sing is to irritate people around you. That's, like, the ultimate situation, when everybody sings, because it like, amplifies the sound, and people who aren't even anywhere near you get to be irritated then.
It's awesome that way.
We still could have Polycast the Musical.
Start spreading the news.
Anyway, only on Polycast could we be talking about espionage and then talk about musicals.
I mean, musicals are a Russian plot.
And it could cause unhappiness.
It could also destroy nearby improvements and buildings.
Inside your riots. Yes,
yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my glass factory!
It could sabotage production.
I'm not doing any work until you shut up.
And I think that takes us to the end of the show.
Right. Whatever. So, yeah. This was Polycast number 156. Our lineup of various personalities. Dan Q, as always.
I spy with my little eye someone that is a gamer.
Mad Jin, as often.
Stop looking at me that way.
The Mian Team, which is the longest name here right now.
I'm a broken feature in real life.
Oh, God. And Oz Benno, I guess.
Yep. I guess that would be me.
He has the best accent here, although followed closely by Dan Q. And myself, Peng Chi, whose name has no relation to his actual ethnicity.
Core date September 8th, 2012. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.